Mr. DeBrun?
Yes. Morning, Your Honors. Peter DeBruni for Plaintiff Appellant Eddie Burnell. I'd like to concentrate my argument on the direct method of proof that we've raised in counts 1 and 4. And I'd like to just talk about the non-race-based evidence in the case to start. Our client was a 15-year full-time continuous employee at the plant. One day, his trainee supervisor asked him to do a job. He starts the job, finds it's unsafe to do, and he stops. Later, he explains he doesn't have time to do it. The next day, the trainee supervisor comes in and attempts to give him a written warning. He doesn't accept the written warning. He goes to the plant manager to appeal. As a result of the appeal, 24 hours later, he's discharged.
Mr. Brim, where in the record will we find evidence that Mr. Burnell told anyone in management that he did not turn down the tools because of safety concerns? It seems clear that the first explanation was a lack of time that he gave. And I understand your position that a jury could conclude that this man did not have time to do it safely, but that really seems like a real stretch. And all that matters is what he told the employer and what the employer honestly believes. So what is the best evidence that he did tell the employer he didn't turn down the tools because of safety concerns? And I really am looking for specific safe record sites.
Well, there's a exhibit. I think it's written by the plant manager. It's his own memorandum of his conversation with Mr. Burnell. And in that memorandum, he says, I understand you cited safety. You're on the right track.
Say it again. I understand.
You're on the right track when you mention safety. So in that conversation, the plant manager.
But you first said if you said it was safety.
No, I'm referencing the memo, and I believe the memo written by the plant manager records that Mr. Burnell had said there was a safety concern, and then the manager went on and wrote what he said to Mr. Burnell in the meeting, you're on the right track with safety. But then he went on, you should just go ahead and do the job. And one of the problems that we say in the case and one of the evidences of pretext is, why was there no follow-up on safety? Secondly, Mr. Burnell mentioned safety to Jill Carvalho, the Denver EEO chief, and she talked to the she told him that there would be an investigation into safety, and she talked to the people at the plant the day before the day of his discharge and said, look into the safety, and they never did. So they were aware, all of the actors in the case were aware of the safety issue, and it just was never investigated. There are no further questions on that point.
Thank you.
In any event, I think that a jury would be suspicious about why a full-time employee, given that record, would be discharged. But then the employer had three systems in place which should have had the effect of slowing down a termination. The first was progressive discipline. And essentially, there was no progressive discipline for Mr. Burnell. When he went to the plant manager, he had at most a written warning. And so the result of an appeal to the plant manager, he would expect, would be he's employed, but he has a written warning, or he's employed and he doesn't have a written warning. Instead, within 24 hours, he's lost his job, which I think brings the focus to Mr. Tatanchian. Second, Judge Roeder, you've mentioned the safety issue, but really that was a major emphasis at the company. They had safety as job one and a bunch of documents in the case, the employee manual, et cetera, and even the tool room manual told the tool room employee to find a secure holder for the tool. And his specific problem was that the holder he found would not hold the tool securely, thus creating a danger when he held it up against a grinding wheel. So when you get to the point of one of the reasons for his discharge, that he wouldn't commit to the tenets of the GEM Constitution, and they have him saying in this commitment letter, I understand I could be terminated, and I'm paraphrasing, if I refuse the instruction of my supervisor again. They precisely were saying, because they hadn't done a safety investigation and apparently didn't care, if he goes out and tells you to do the same thing again, you're going to be fired. But in any event, the safety regime they had did not slow them down. Third, they had what's called a GEM constitution, which was sort of their hybrid employee manual, a one-page thing. They said in that manual, again, it emphasizes safety and says you should have mutual respect. And Douglas Krauss, one manager above Todd Gates, who was the trainee supervisor, said that meant you should have a reasonable tolerance for some difference in versions of events. So in this case, we have the plant manager investigating, which wasn't his usual course. Usually, he lets other people get the facts. This time, he went out, and in 15 seconds, talking to the trainee supervisor, he concluded that my client was lying about if he had time, and that Todd Gates was telling the truth.
What interpretation could a jury give the playing the race card statement that would support your claim? I take it from the briefs. You interpreted this testimony to mean that Tatonchian accused Burnell of playing the race card, but Burnell denies he ever mentioned race. How is Tatonchian's accusation evidence of Tatonchian's racial bias? I'm in trouble with that.
Well, I think if you look at, again, we're looking at this pile of evidence. That's our method of proof. And Mr. Burnell had complained about Joe Payne, who was the trainer in the tool room. And he said, look, Joe Payne does not want to work with black men. He is not training me. He has threatened that he will retire. He's not giving me any training on the Mazak machine. And then you finally get into this conversation where there's the three of them, Mr. Tatonchian, Mr. Krauss, and Mr. Burnell. And Mr. Tatonchian is clearly agitated, saying you're the saddest employee you've ever seen. You're lucky to work here. Why don't you find another? He's clearly angry. And Mr. Burnell explains, his rage. And with that, he comes out, you're playing the race card. So I think the combination of the anger, and there should not have been anger at this situation, a first-time offense, why is there anger? All we have is a written warning, and all of a sudden, boom, you're playing the race card. That indicates, I think a jury could believe, that race was a reason, a proximate cause for the dismissal decision. Those are the non-racial facts in the case, and then you get to the various explanations. We say approximate cause is race. The other side says, well, there are a number of reasons, and you go back and forth on those. But where we are now is we're trying to get to a jury, and we think a fair question for the jury is it race or is it what they say?
What, for the retaliation claim, what did he complain about racially motivated practices at Gates? It seems most of the complaints are 10 or 12 years old. What incident is closest to termination? And how close in time was it?
I think he was complaining about Mr. Payne, who would not train him and who wouldn't work with black people. Mr. Tatonchian investigated that, and the investigation went nowhere. There's no evidence in the record that there was any talking to Mr. Payne or any cure of that. I see I'm in addition, there was Mazak training, which was fairly close, and Scott Shockey. Mr. Tatonchian was aware of the racial insults from Scott Shockey toward Mr. Burnell. See, I'm out of time here.
You've got a little time left, actually.
Oh, okay. I think it was mainly Mr. Payne, where he was complaining about Mr. Payne's treatment of him. There was the Mazak training, which Ms. Carvalho, the EEO officer, was aware of, and which she talked to Mr. Tatonchian about. And Mr. Payne is the one who said to Mr. Burnell, you'll never run the Mazak. So it was clear that he wasn't getting the Mazak training in at least 04. That's when Mr. Mr. Tatanchian took over. And if you look at, I think it's Exhibit 34, which is Ms. Carvalho's letter to the EEOC, in Exhibit 3 to that, she has the racial makeup of the tool room department. And she says only the senior people, operator A, left there or went to the MAZAC training. So that's the racial composition, even though that exhibit, I think, is dated 06. If you go back to 04, I don't think there was that much change in the tool room. And the racial composition, if you look, is mainly white, 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 white. So I think a jury could look at that and say, gee, the white guys, the senior white, the white guys went, you didn't go. And so that, I think, is the what Mr. Tatanchian knew about the activities he was complaining about.
Thank you, Counselor.
You're welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors. Arthur Sternberg on behalf of the Applee Gates Rubber Company. Mr. DeBruni concentrated his arguments on directed evidence, on the direct method of proof. And he starts with that from Mr. Brunel's perspective, he was assigned a task and he tried to do it, could not find a safe way. He was given a warning that escalated into termination. That's the essence of his direct method case. From Gates' perspective, that's not at all how the facts appear. That's not the facts that Mr. Brunel gave to Gates. Instead, Mr. Brunel had claimed that he was simply given a note, and the significance of being given a note that said, if you have time, versus a verbal instruction that these need to be done, is a critical one because the machine, because a particular machine had been breaking tools and there were no spares of the tool, so that if during Mr. Brunel's shift a tool had broken, then they would have lost production on a machine. The district court pointed out that these facts were not disputed by Mr. Brunel's evidence, that the tools that he was assigned to turn down were exactly in the same spot as when his supervisor, Todd Gates, had left them, that they appeared not to have been touched, and that in the meetings with Mr. Tatanchian and Mr. Krause, while Mr. Brunel had raised a safety issue, he was unable to explain any of the steps that he had supposedly taken to find a safe way. And his version that he made all of these efforts fundamentally inconsistent with the undisputed fact that those tools were left in the same place and appeared to be untouched. At least from Gates' perspective, that would appear to be a non-discriminatory reason for discipline. Further reinforcing that perspective is that even though this was a critical task, during his shift, Mr. Brunel did not notify any managers that he was unable to provide spares, and therefore there was a risk that the machine could get could go down because of broken tool. He should have let management know so that management could make a decision at that point in time what to do. He didn't do any of that. He waited till the next day, till Todd Gates approached him and told him, why didn't you turn these down? And he didn't claim safety to Todd Gates. He said, I don't have time. In their briefs, they tried to make consistent that he didn't have time because he couldn't find a safe way. But if you're trying to explain a situation as to why didn't you do something, saying I didn't have time is certainly a more cavalier answer than to say, here's the things that I tried to do, and there was no way that I could find a way to do it safely. So we go to the progressive discipline system and whether there were any disparities. Now, they don't give you any examples of where a white employee was treated more favorably than Mr. Brunel. In fact, we show you examples of where white employees were fired without being given a chance to sign a commitment letter. One of those is Scott Shockey, who directed the N-word to Mr. Brunel and was promptly fired, given no opportunity to sign a commitment letter. Another example was a 20-year employee like Mr. Brunell, who was white, who was found to have falsified a document, a comparable offense to Mr. Brunell's lying to Tatanchian and Krauss about what was the instruction that was given to him. That person, that white person, was fired without being given a commitment letter. But Mr. Brunell was not fired for lying to Mr. Tatanchian and Krauss about what the work instruction was given. He was given the opportunity to protect his job. It was not an unreasonable requirement to expect him to sign the commitment letter that was drafted by Ms. Carvalho. Tatanchian had wanted to fire him immediately for lying to him. He was outraged about what is admitted to be a lie, and that specific lie was that Brunell had claimed until his deposition that he had only been given a note that said, do this if you can, versus a verbal instruction to do it. And he admitted in his deposition that, yes, in fact, he was given a verbal instruction to do it. Tatanchian looks at this and says, one, I can see that this was an important task to be done. Brunell is unable to explain to me that what steps he took to do it. The fact,
you know, his best argument is for retaliation when he was fired the day after Tatanchian accuses him of playing the race card. And you faulted him for failing to disambiguate his testimony about the race car comment. But on summary judgment, it's your obligation to demonstrate that there are no genuine issues of material fact. And why wasn't it your burden to ask him what he meant when he said that at his deposition?
Well, I did ask him, but it's not my burden of proof to...
What do you mean you did ask him?
I did not ask him, did he use the words race car? I asked him about... I asked him many questions about race car, but it was his burden of proof to establish the foundation that, in fact, the words race car were used. I think
I don't understand that.
Well,
because throughout your brief, forgive me, Mr. Sternberg, but you seem to be shifting the burden to the plaintiff in certain instances. You faulted him for not having documentary evidence that he took the operator A test multiple times. Well, he says he does. He doesn't need to corroborate that statement with documents. It's up to you to present evidence, not just a simple denial, but evidence that there were no prior tests. Yet I didn't see any references to an affidavit or a statement under oath, that the company checked its records and he took the test only once. And I'm wondering what we should make of, these gaps in the record.
Well, there's a total lack in the record. We did produce his personnel file. What was ever in his personnel file was available to the plaintiff to present as evidence that he did, in fact, take these various tests. I also wanted to point out that there is no evidence that he was ever subjected to a higher scoring standard than any non-African American. As to what is the burden of proof here?
The plaintiff. Do you have no objective evidence? I'm sorry.
There's no objective evidence that a higher scoring requirement was ever applied to a non-African American. The plaintiff has the burden of proof to establish sufficient evidence to defeat judgment as a matter of law. Once he defeats that, in a motion for summary judgment, a defendant does not have any burden of proof other than to point out that there is an absence of genuine issue of material fact. It's up to the plaintiff to show that, in fact, this race card comment, those words were used, and all he does is has a very ambiguous passage in his deposition that leaves it ambiguous as to were the words used or were they not used, whether it's a characterization or not a characterization. He had the opportunity in his affidavit, which he submitted in opposition to motion for summary judgment, to disambiguate the evidence. His evidence throughout is ambiguous, indefinite, and very sketchy. That's what an affidavit is proper for. That's something that if he's an inarticulate plaintiff, the plaintiff's counsel can help him in setting forth those facts in an affidavit. That he didn't do. But let's go to what if Tatonchian did say that he was playing the race card. I don't think that that establishes any inference pointing to the Tatonchian's state of mind. Now, Judge Rovner, you said that may indicate that retaliation. However, the Tatonchian had wanted to fire him, but Carvalho, the corporate EEOC specialist, had said, no, you can't do that for lying. She's the one who came up with this requirement of a commitment letter, which was something that was used with various employees. And there's no argument that she was even aware that there was this race card comment at the time that she developed this requirement, drafted it, and provided the opportunity for Mr. Brunel to sign it and attach his own statement to it. Had he done that, then his only requirement was that he follow the lawful directions that his supervisor gave him. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks to both counsel. Your time has expired, but I'll give you one more minute.
Your Honor, just picking up on that last point, we sent you a letter on the Staub case, which just came back from the Supreme Court, and the argument about Jill Carvalho seems to be out now, that you can't have somebody who supposedly investigates and takes away the bad motivation of, say, somebody like Tatonchian. Secondly, I'd point out that although there's this argument that our client lied, in fact, at 266 of his deposition, he says that in both the first and second meeting with the plant manager on December 19th, he told them that if he had time, he wasn't talking just about the note. Then as far as he didn't explain the steps on this tool, there are no steps. Once you put it in here and it sags, that's it. You don't go further because it's dangerous to go further.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.